bloody combat that had begun almost with the first landing of the first ship on the first fatal shore in Virginia. The final destruction of the last of the hostile tribes would not take place for a few more years. Time would be yet required to round them all up, or starve them out, or exterminate their sources of food, or run them to ground in shallow canyons, or kill them outright. For the moment, the question was one of hard, unalloyed will. There had been brief spasms of official vengeance and retribution before, J.M. Chivington's and George Armstrong Custer's savage massacres of Cheyennes in 1864 and 1868 were examples. But in those days, there was no real attempt to destroy the tribes on a larger scale, no stomach for it. That had changed, and that morning, the change assumed the form of an order, barked out through the lines of command to the men of the 4th Cavalry and 11th Infantry to go forth and kill Comanches. It was the end of anything like tolerance, the beginning of the final solution. The white men were grunts, bluecoats, cavalry, and dragoons, mostly veterans of the war between the states, who now found themselves at the edge of the known universe, ascending to the turreted rock towers that gated the fabled Llano Estacado, Coronado's term for it, meaning Palisaded Plains of West Texas, a country populated exclusively by the most hostile Indians on the continent, where few U.S. soldiers had ever gone before. The Llano was a place of extreme desolation, a vast, trackless, and featureless ocean of grass, where white men became lost and disoriented and died of thirst. A place where the Imperial Spanish had once marched confidently forth to hunt Comanches, only to find that they themselves were the hunted, the ones to be slaughtered. In 1864, Kit Carson had led a large force of federal troops from Santa Fe and attacked a Comanche band at a trading post called Adobe Walls, north of modern-day Amarillo. He had survived it, but had come within a whisker of watching his three companies of cavalry and infantry destroyed. The troops were now going back because enough was enough, because President Grant's vaunted peace policy toward the remaining Indians, run by his gentle Quaker appointees, had failed utterly to bring peace, and finally because the exasperated General-in-Chief of the Army, William Tecumseh Sherman, had ordered it so. Sherman's chosen agent of destruction was a Civil War hero named Ranald Slidell McKenzie, a difficult, moody, and implacable young man who had graduated first in his class from West Point in 1862 and had finished the Civil War, remarkably, as a brevet brigadier general. Because his hand was gruesomely disfigured from war wounds, the Indians called him No Finger Chief, or Bad Hand. A complex destiny awaited him. Within 4 years, he would prove himself the most brutally effective Indian fighter in American history. In roughly that same time period, while General George Armstrong Custer achieved world fame in failure and catastrophe, McKenzie would become obscure in victory. But it was McKenzie, not Custer, who would teach the rest of the army how to fight Indians. As he moved his men across the broken stream-crossed country, past immense herds of buffalo and prairie dog towns that stretched to the horizon, Colonel McKenzie did not have a clear idea of what he was doing, where precisely he was going, or how to fight Plains Indians in their homelands. Neither did he have the faintest idea that he would be the one largely responsible for defeating the last of the hostile Indians. He was new to this sort of Indian fighting, and would make many mistakes in the coming weeks. He would learn from them. For now, McKenzie was the instrument of retribution. He had been dispatched to kill Comanches in their Great Plains fastness because, 6 years after the end of the Civil War, the western frontier was an open and bleeding wound, a smoking ruin littered with corpses and charred chimneys, a place where anarchy and torture killings had replaced the rule of law, where Indians, and especially Comanches, raided at will. Victorious in war, unchallenged by foreign foes in North America for the first time in its history, the Union now found itself unable to deal with the handful of remaining Indian tribes that had not been destroyed, assimilated, or forced to retreat meekly onto reservations where they quickly learned the meaning of abject suffering.